Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. In recent years, California and the nation has begun an examination of the criminal justice system. A long-overlooked effect of various criminal convictions were myriad registration regimen, where someone who suffered a conviction would have to register annually with local law enforcement. Some of these registrations would be accessible to law enforcement, but also to potential employers or even your neighbors. Drug users had to register for several years, as did such individuals as gang members or arsonists. Perhaps the most onerous registration requirement was for convicted sex offenders. After a review by the state legislature, California has made major changes in who has to register as a sex offender and for how long, and which, if any, of these changes apply retroactively. Who is behind these changes, and why should we not be concerned? What do these changes mean for public safety, if anything? And what, if any, safeguards were put in place? When do these changes restore the ability of some of these folks to resume a normal life years after sometimes very minor offenses? Where can someone turn for help? As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, our number, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255, where we pay the freight. It's 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guest cannot give you specific legal advice, as we don't have all of the salient facts of your situation. We're happy to share the legal principles to help guide you in your decision-making. And the views they express might not be those of their employers or their individual clients. Again, you can call us with any question about registration following a criminal conviction. You're not limited to jump in exactly where we may be in our conversation tonight. So to help guide us through this overview tonight, Lisa McGuire is the chief defender of the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar Association. Before joining the management of the Private Defender Program, Lisa defended those accused of crimes in her private practice. And early in her career, Lisa served as the Deputy San Mateo County District Attorney. And from the office of the San Mateo County District Attorney, Shinmi Chang serves as one of three assistants district attorney and oversees the Sex Crimes Unit. Alana Cradier defended youth and adults in juvenile delinquency and criminal court. Lana served as a deputy public defender for 11 years in Riverside County before starting her private practice in the Bay Area. No longer in private practice, Lana now serves as assistant managing attorney for the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar Association. And with that, Shinmi, Lana, Lisa, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. Thanks for having us here.
Hi, Jeff.
You know, before we go much further, I'd like to start with a discussion of what was. So first, where did all this change come from? Shinmi, did all this change come as a shock to prosecutors?
Not at all, Jeff. Actually, this is legislation that was promulgated by the district attorneys. LA County, for example, sponsored this bill. And the intent was really to clean up the registry. And I'd like to go back to 1947, if I may, because that's when the registry started. The California Sex Offender Registry started with the Black Dahlia murder case in Los Angeles. The victim's name was Elizabeth Short, and her badly mutilated and denuded body was found in Los Angeles. And there was, of course, outcry among the community members, and they decided to start a registry, really as an investigative tool. And in 1947, it was retroactive back to 1944. And today there are 150,000 registrants in California on the sex offender registry. And so, again, this is the nation's oldest and largest registry. And the intent of this legislation was to really balance out the registry in a meaningful way to restore its usefulness as a law enforcement tool, to reduce the administrative burden on the law enforcement agencies, because there is a lot of resources that go into monitoring offenders who pose little to no risk of reoffending. And then there's an equity component to the new change in the law as well, but I'll talk more about that later.
So where that leads me naturally is the equity component. Let's talk a little bit anecdotally about what some folks might have experienced prior to this change in the law.
So prior to the change in the law, registration in California was lifetime registration. California was one of four states in the United States that mandated lifetime registration for convicted sex offenders. With this change in the law, there's a huge paradigm shift, and we go to a 10, 20, or lifetime tiering system. And the tiering depends mostly on the offense with which you're charged. And the idea is, as I said before, to get the people who pose little to no risk off the registry as long as they are eligible to do so. And the equity component that I talked about was that part of the legislation also gives parity to members of our LGBTQIA community who previously were subject to mandatory registration where heterosexual statutory rape defendants were not. So that was an important piece of this legislation as well.
So Lisa, Alana, would you like to join in at this point and tell us a little bit about what might be a common experience to some of the defense clients, some of the folks that suffered convictions quite a while ago?
Yes, Jeff, thank you. So I think that for the defense bar, what's really critical about this change is the recognition that the burden of lifetime registration was really grossly out of proportion with some of the behavior that had been criminalized and people had been convicted for. So anecdotally, you could have an individual who was charged with conduct that could be as de minimis as grabbing somebody on their behind or grabbing, you know, somebody on their breast. So that would be a misdemeanor sexual battery, and that could potentially have led to lifetime registration. So, you know, that's, in my opinion, rather de minimis conduct that could have been engaged in by an 18-year-old in, you know, high school gym. It could have been one guy grabbing another guy behind in the locker room. If the victim of that had chosen to pursue it and wanted to prosecute, and the DA's office went ahead and prosecuted that, that could have resulted in lifetime registration. Lifetime registration comes with incredible burdens for the individual, for their family members. It can interfere with an individual's ability to make a living. It can interfere with where an individual resides. It can interfere going into the future with their ability to spend time at their children's school. There are all sorts of implications of registration, sexual registration, that were just grossly out of proportion with some of the conduct that could fall within the statutes. So while it began as an effort to relieve to relieve law enforcement from trying to weed through the less serious offenders and identify the more serious offenders as an investigative tool, I think that there is a benefit that's come out of this in recognizing that those low-risk offenders probably don't belong on that registry at all and, you know, potentially never belonged on that registry. So we don't view this as a perfect solution, but we certainly view it as a good place to start. And, you know, it's better than not starting at all. So does that help?
Well, it does, but could the sentencing court have simply said no registration, or maybe a year of registration while you're on probation, something like that?
Some offenses did have discretion, but many of them did not. So there certainly are misdemeanor offenses that did not allow for discretion. So the only way to avoid it would have been to go to trial and beat the charge or to get the district attorney to dismiss the charge. And I know anecdotally that the district attorney's office historically was not willing to dismiss charges based on the fact that the misdemeanor came with a lifetime registration requirement. So no, you weren't always in a situation where there was discretion being exercised.
And as I learned very early on in my own practice as a public defender, you could have very inconsistent results for similar conduct. If somebody is convicted of indecent exposure, displaying themselves, they have to register for life. Whereas you could have people engaged in lewd conduct, that's sexual activity in public, and yet there's no registration requirement for that potentially.
There were other distinctions as well. There were other situations. Shinmi already touched upon it. I think that the LGBTQIA community was subjected to more onerous registration requirements for the same behavior than heterosexual people would have been subjected to. So it was being unfairly applied across many different areas.
And for the benefit of listeners, the law didn't relieve anybody just yet. People that were put on this list are still on it. Nothing's changed for those folks yet. Is that fair to say?
That's right. I want to really emphasize that this is an offender-driven petition. So the DA's office and the courts are not under any obligation to comb through our records. And in fact, we cannot do that. The statute mandates that each offender apply and petition the court for this relief. But I want to assure the public that there is a strong public safety component built into the process because there are multiple eyes on the petition throughout this whole process. Law enforcement are the initial gatekeepers. The DA's office will do a vigorous review of the petition de novo once it comes to our office. And in San Mateo County, the petitions are going to be reviewed by experienced sexual assault prosecutors. And then finally, the court will also review the petition. So this is not a very quick process, but it's designed so that any mistakes will be caught.
And on the other side of that, Jeff, we, Lana and I, the reason that we were so pleased that you were willing to host this segment is because we do want to get word out to those that may be eligible that we are here to assist them in doing the initial analysis to determine whether or not they may be eligible to file the petition and to help them in filing that petition and seeking the relief. So it's really important to us that people know if they are residing within San Mateo County, and that's the requirement, is that you have to petition in the county within which you live. If you live in San Mateo County and you think you might be eligible for this type of relief, then we are here to assist you. If we determine that you need to go to a different county, we can direct you to the county, the relevant county. And if we determine that you're not quite eligible yet, because there are requirements with regard to time and minimum registration periods that are going to come into play, and not everybody is going to be eligible just because the law passed, and we can talk a little bit more about that. But for those that are, those that think they might be, we certainly want to get the word out that we're here to help.
And for those that live in other counties, this is statewide.
Reach out to similar organizations, their local public defender's office. And I'm sure there are plenty of lawyers in private practice that would also be willing to take on the work and assist.
I just want to follow up with one thing. It's technically the county of registration, which should be the county of residence, but there might be offenders who are out of compliance. And one of the prerequisites is that you must currently be fully compliant with your 290 registrants. So if you are living somewhere but registered elsewhere, that's something you have to iron out before you can start this process.
Always best to clean it up and come forward with clean hands.
You know, California law is written such that you only have to be currently in compliance. Other states have a consecutive compliance requirement. California opted not to go that route.
Lana, we were talking earlier, and one of the things that struck me is how many of the inequities in registration could be something best described as youthful indiscretions. Not forcible sexual acts and not rapes or things of that nature, but really, for lack of a better expression, really dumb things that young people do. Are young people even able to understand these consequences?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, Jeff. I think that we all know, we've all been young, right? We've all been 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and we've all done things when we were 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and that we said, oh my gosh, I cannot believe I did that. And so we know from, you know, not just science, but from common sense and everyday experience that young people mature at different rates, they develop at different rates, they experiment sexually at different times in their youth, and they learn right from wrong at different rates as well. And this bill or this new law actually treats juvenile adjudications differently from adult convictions. So young people who had juvenile adjudications and went to DJJ and were required to register for life can now petition the court after 5 years of registration or 10 years of registration, depending on their offense. Whereas for adults, it's a 10 years requirement period. So the law does take into account the difference between juveniles in that way. But something, you know, I think uniquely interesting is, you know, an 18-year-old commits the same offense as a 17-year-old. And that 18-year-old is probably no different from the 17-year-old when it comes to their development or their maturity. But under the law, an 18-year-old is treated as an adult, and they would have to register for life. And they're now in the 10-20 life new tiering as opposed to the 510, right? So the law still isn't perfect. It doesn't recognize the science around the fact that our brain doesn't fully develop till we're in our mid-20s. But we're making progress.
So let's talk a little bit about how this bill came into being. Now, Shinmi, you mentioned before that this began with prosecutors in LA County, which was the main sponsor, and I believe Alameda was involved as well. When this got to the legislature, who was really behind it? Who was opposed to it? Was it all a bunch of civil libertarians and defense attorneys who latched onto a friendly DA's office, or were there really anybody else in favor of it or opposed to it?
Well, the bill was authored by Senator Scott Wiener, and I am not sure how many people actually opposed the bill. Certainly among the prosecutors community, I'm not aware of people who opposed the bill. There might have been a quibble over minor details of the bill, but as you said, I think it enjoyed fairly wide support across the board.
Yeah, you're right, Shinmi. This is Lana. You know, I was looking at the legislative history today, and I noted that there was no opposition in one of the publications available on the legislative website. There was wide support from both defense organizations, civil rights organizations, and from law enforcement and district attorney organizations.
And I think that part of that was the focus of this effort being on the benefit to law enforcement. And I think that that is what enabled them to garner so much support, is rather than focusing on the benefit to the registrant, the focus of the legislative movement was on the benefit to law enforcement. Let's get rid of those low-level offenders that are clogging up the system. Because if everybody is registering for life and there's no distinction between the person that committed a low-level misdemeanor versus the person that committed a very high-level serious felony sexual offense, then the benefit in using it as an investigative tool becomes, you know, less and less. If people are looking on Megan's Law website and there are tens of thousands of faces there and you can't distinguish between who's the serious, you know, sexual predator and who's the low-level misdemeanant, it doesn't mean much, not to mention the impact that that has on the person who's on that website for the de minimis conduct. But I think that the way it garnered so much support was by focusing on the benefit to law enforcement, by being able to unclog the system so that it could maybe be used again as an effective investigative tool.
Shinmi, did you want to jump in?
Sure. I do want to point out that some misdemeanants, sex offenders, go on to commit more serious crimes. And I really do want to emphasize that even though it may just be a misdemeanor on somebody's record, the impact to the victim may nonetheless be very severe. And so I just didn't want that to get lost in our conversation.
One of the other things that jumped out at me when we started talking about this is the idea that as somebody who lives in a neighborhood with a lot of people in it, if I look at the Megan's Law website, I'm fairly skilled at looking through this stuff and knowing what it means. But to a layperson who doesn't have legal training, they're going to look through the website in its current form, see people in their own neighborhood that seem a little scary. And it'll be hard for people in the current form to distinguish between a neighbor who maybe opened her blouse inappropriately when she was young, or somebody who's traumatizing people, either raping them or some really scary stuff.
Yes, but even, again, the lower level conduct that you describe, you and Lisa describe, may nonetheless be very traumatizing to the victims in those cases. I also want to, from a victim point of view, I want to point out that this is not an automatic washout period. I want to assure the sexual assault victims who were told at the time of the plea that the offender was going to register for lifetime that, one, this is an offender-driven process, but there are safeguards to make sure that the offender was offense-free during the time of the tolling, at the time of the registration period, meaning that there's a tolling aspect to this piece of legislation, such that you were continuing to engage in criminality. That 10-year period for misdemeanors, for example, is tolled or stopped, and you could have months or even years added onto the tiering time before you are eligible to petition.
That's
one of the safeguards for our victims out there.
What types of offenses would have that effect?
So that's a good question. So we can talk broadly more about ineligibility. So anybody who's currently incarcerated or under any kind of supervision is ineligible to petition. And that's incarceration or supervision for any crime, including misdemeanors. And any 290 conviction that's a misdemeanor, and that's failure to register as a sex offender, will add 1 year to that period of registration. And every felony conviction for failing to register will add another 3 years onto whatever period that you were supposed to register for. So those are some of the safeguards that are in place. And we want to make sure that the people who are getting off this registry are getting off because they have truly been risk or truly are risk-free.
Let's talk about a little bit about the process that led to these tiers. How did people come across the idea of 10 years or 20 years or lifetime? Where do those numbers come from? Lana, I think you did a little research on this, didn't you?
Where does the 10 or 20 years come from? You mean how did they choose 10 or 20?
Yes, and which offenses went into each category?
Well, I don't know the specific answer to that, but what I can tell you is that there's a lot there. This was based on research. This wasn't like, let's just arbitrarily put in 10 years or arbitrarily put in 20 years. There was, you know, if you look at the legislative history, the author's comments included an open quote statement after decades of research, we now have a much better sense of who is at high risk of reoffending and who is not, close quote. And that's was part of the author's explanation for why they wrote the bill the way they did. And the California Sex Offender Management Board contributed to the writing of this law. And so they're a state organization that has a lot of data to rely on. So I think that's another assurance for the victims out there or for concerned community members that this bill was really based on research and not just a desire to make it easier for law enforcement or to address equities. It was a combination of motivations, which included decades of research. But, you know, on that point, I think the equities are important. And I think part of what it's a vicious cycle, you know, when somebody has to register, if they're homeless because of it, or if they're in poverty because of it, because they can't get a job, you know, we know that homelessness and poverty are tied to criminality. And so if our goal is public safety, if removing them from the sex registry is going to improve their chances of being employed, because we know scientifically they're not going to reoffend, and improve their chances of living outside of poverty, then maybe our communities will become safer. And that can be an assurance also for victims that this law is designed to really improve public safety at large as well.
So ultimately, what it really comes down to is a balancing between really how onerous we want to make life moving forward to some, but also protecting public safety and really making sure that the people that we need to be watching are being watched.
I think it's important to just say, and I respect Shinmi's position with regard to the victims, and certainly anybody who is the victim of a sexual assault deserves, you know, our sympathy, and they deserve protection from future assault and all of that. But I think it's important to distinguish being on the registry from keeping victims safe. So if we're looking at being on the registry as some additional form of punishment, the shame of being on the registry makes the victim feel better, then we're looking at this all wrong, because that's not the point of the registry. The point of the registry, as Shinmi has informed us and educated us, is to assist law enforcement in tracking down people who might be suspects in future assaults or future investigations. And so, you know, to say that, well, you know, it's going to make the victim feel bad, or we don't want to minimize the needs of the victim by removing the person from the registry just because the conduct was de minimis, I think that's sort of getting off point, because the point of the registry, again, it's not to shame and further punish them. It's supposed to be used in a meaningful way. And if there is no meaningful use to have somebody who was at a point in their life, did something stupid, and, you know, it's not going to happen again, and there's no suggestion that it will ever happen again, then having them on this registry really doesn't serve any point. So I don't see it as an insult to a victim that a person is removed from the registry. As long as that person is deemed not to pose some future risk of reoffending, then I think that that's what we need to be concerned about.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. We'll be back right after this.
Hey, I'm Saroja Coelho, in for Tom Power. Los Lobos went from playing backyard parties in the 70s to establishing a new sound blending roots rock and traditional Mexican folk. Luis Perez, one of the founders, joins me as the band releases a new album that's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q from the CBC just ahead for the 7 o'clock hour on your member-supported 91.7 FM and online at KALW.org. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Next week, we'll be at Your Legal Rights visiting another discussion on probating your small estate. You'll be hearing from estate planning attorneys on exactly what you need to do for a small estate that perhaps you don't want to need legal help and don't want to go through the process by yourself. Maybe you do. Probating the small estate, that's next week on Your Legal Rights. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're taking a look at the profound changes taking place in the requirements for registration following a criminal conviction. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, registration following a criminal conviction. You don't have to jump in exactly where we may be in our conversation. One of the things that we were talking a little bit about are where to get help. Is this something that people can really do on their own?
I think so. It's important to point out, first of all, though, that offenders are not eligible to petition until their first birthday after July 1st of 2021. So if you have an October birthday, you are not eligible to petition. But after that, it's one, a matter of getting proof of current registration. And then there are forms that were made by the Judicial Council. And you can find those forms very easily on our county's court website. If you go to the San Mateo County Court website and go on the Judicial Council Form tab, it will take you to a search button. And if you type in sex offender, it will take you to the CR-415 forms. And so they're very easy to fill out. I think many of them have checkboxes. And so, yes, this is something that conceivably somebody can do without an attorney's help. Once those forms are filled out, you file them with the court, again, in the county where you are registered. And if the county of conviction is different for you, you must also serve the county where you are convicted. You also have to serve the DA's office where you are registered and or convicted, as well as the law enforcement where you're registered and or convicted.
Lisa, you're shaking your hands. Is this a trap for the unwary?
No, I just disagree. I mean, no offense to Shinmi, but I just think that this is more complicated than that. And there are other factors that may come into play. It may require an analysis of a rap sheet. It may require a review of an an out-of-county conviction or out-of-state, frankly. So this is obviously something that would be very important to an individual who thinks they might be eligible. I would not suggest that people try and take this into their own hands. I think that it would make a lot more sense for them to refer the matter to professionals who are trained to look at this and to help them. I'm going to turn it over to Lana to sort of describe what the process would be in this county if they were to call our office.
And let me jump in real quick before you do and point out to people that if you qualify for appointed counsel, and most people on this list would, there's no longer a requirement that you repay the county for your service, for the services of counsel. So there's really no reason not to go and seek help if it's available to you. And with that, Lana, why don't you jump in?
Yeah, you know, I agree with Lisa. As I was reviewing the law, I mean, there's pages and pages and pages and so many words, and it's a lot for somebody who's not trained as a lawyer to read and review and understand. And there's really a lot of detail in there that's important and significant to their ability to succeed with the petition. And the forms themselves, yes, I agree with Shinmi that, you know, you just check stuff off. But if you read the actual, you know, sentence that you're checking off, yes or no, the verbiage in there is very, it's legalese, you know, and a lawyer can really help that petitioner understand what that language means and if in fact they could check that box off or not. And then you have to sign these forms, right? You have to say to the court that what you're putting on this form is true and accurate and correct. And if you don't have the legal knowledge to really understand that and you mistakenly say it's true or accurate or correct, and you go to court and you're, you know, you're caught off guard that it's not true, accurate or correct, that could affect your credibility. And a lawyer could really help you avoid those types of struggles and challenges. And with us, if you call our office, somebody will speak to you and get a sense for where you're at in your registration history, what your offense is, whether you have a tier designation letter from the law enforcement agency that tells us what tier you've been placed in by the Department of Justice. And if we determine that you're in a position where a petition can and should be filed in the near future, we will get you an attorney to assist you, so that you can begin the process of researching and preparing to file your petition, and so that you can mount a defense in the event there is objection by the prosecution. So I hope that people will call us and seek assistance from us or even a private lawyer if they can afford one.
But one person you don't want to call is the prosecution, because you put them between a rock and the hard place when you call the prosecutor. They're not equipped to assist you. Let me turn it over to Dexter from South San Francisco. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, Jeff. Good program tonight. My question is, if someone has to register in California but moves to American Samoa, would they still have to register there? Thank you.
So, go ahead, Lana.
Well, you know, it just depends on the law in that new state or country or location where the person goes. So wherever the person moves, they have to find out what the law is in that state or country and follow the law of that state or country.
So in California, for example, Dexter, the law provides that if you're convicted of an offense that would require registration here, California is going to make you register, even if it didn't in the state where you were convicted. And the opposite is true. If you're convicted in California, it's really going to be the law where you live that's going to determine if you need to register or not.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. You know, Shinmi, I could tell you wanted to say something when I chimed in about not calling the prosecution. Do you want to run with that?
No, I mean, we do not engage in conversations with the defense, but I wanted to circle back with the defendants, I meant to say. What I wanted to circle back on, though, was something about the process. I certainly did not mean to discourage anyone from seeking legal help, and we appreciate the assist by the private defender panel, because I think it will help in many ways. But I just wanted to point out that the system is designed to be user-friendly by offenders. And it's primarily because law enforcement is tasked with that first level of triage. So when you get your offender tiering compliance registration or completion form, law enforcement does a deep dive into that offender's history and will notify you as well as the DA's office and the courts whether or not that person is eligible.
Let me back up just a little bit. You talked about a form, and that's number one. It may not be your first step, but the other is the description you gave sounds like a lot of words and pretty legalese for somebody hearing this program.
Well, the offender should ideally be registering every year with law enforcement. So they would go back to that same agency and get a 290 compliance form. It's a one-page form that the agency will print out. It's generated or it originates with the Department of Justice, and law enforcement will print out that form and hand it to you so that you can attach it to your petition.
Jeff, I want to just chime in that there's always the possibility that the tier designation provided by law enforcement is inaccurate. I think it will generally be accurate, but there's always the possibility that it is not. And so that's something we can also take a look at. And then there are also many letters that are going to indicate that the individual is in a tier to be determined. And so that's not going to be of much help to the individual. And so, again, I think that these are complicated and important issues, and getting it right is going to, I think, occur more frequently if the individual has the assistance of a, you know, trained criminal defense attorney that knows how to read a rap sheet and knows how to read the tier designation letter and can provide the assistance. Because, I mean, the thing that I'm trying to avoid is people going through all this effort. They may find out that they're not eligible at all. They may start the process themselves tonight, go on the website and start filling out all these forms and get their hopes up, only to learn that they're not eligible. Where we can explain that to them right up front, we can take the information and do the initial analysis and try to give them a realistic idea of whether or not they are close to being eligible for this relief, whether they are potentially currently eligible, or whether they have another, you know, 7 years to wait before they become eligible to even petition for the relief.
One of the greater problems that I foresee coming up, and it speaks to your point, Lisa, but it's the next level of it, which is you not only have to worry about who's eligible, but who's suitable. And I could foresee that if people go by themselves, they're not going to be in the best position to argue when perhaps either the court on the first read or a prosecutor looking at the case may feel the person's inappropriate, and suddenly someone finds themselves in over their head and not able to express why in a way that a trained professional could.
So we've thought about that in this county. There's a working group of judges, probation officers, prosecutors, and defense attorneys who have thought this through. And in those, what we expect to be rare cases where we are objecting to a petition where the person is statutorily eligible, then at that point, we are going to refer the case to the private defender panel for appointment of counsel, assuming that counsel already has not already been provided for by the PDP. So we want to ensure that that process goes smoothly and fairly for the petitioner. There will not be a contested hearing where a person is unrepresented unless he chooses to do so.
Now that, from what I understand, is a uniquely San Mateo County position, that they would automatically refer it to the private defender. Do we have reason to think that there are similar provisions in store in other counties of the state? Or do we think that since there's no right to counsel, if people get in on their own, they're liable to find themselves over their head?
I don't know what other public defender offices in other counties have worked out.
Do we have any information on some of our neighboring counties or what other agencies are experiencing yet?
The word that I've gotten is that agencies throughout the state are preparing to provide assistance. San Diego County sort of took the lead on putting together a working group. They had an amazing law clerk that was working with them, Kelly Schiffman, who did much of the groundwork in starting to put together information that would clarify the process and sort of get things moving along. And that's been shared widely throughout the state. They began a working group. So I have reason to believe that most counties will be on board with providing assistance.
But is there an automatic kick out if somebody's representing themselves and is at that final stage where the others are saying no? Do most counties have a provision where before they adjudicate it, the person is referred to counsel?
I'm not aware of that. I just don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
So what is the first step? when we were talking before, Shinmei, you mentioned about people that filed with the court, even attorneys that had filed with the court as a first step. But that isn't supposed to be the first step, is it?
Well, it can be the first step if they've complied with the prerequisite step of getting that proof of current registration. And then after that, it's a matter of serving the various agencies that I previously described. And from there, the clock starts ticking. Once the petition is filed, the local law enforcement agency has 60 days to investigate and to make that initial determination of whether or not the offender is eligible to petition. If the offender is ineligible, for example, due to the fact that he's still in custody, the court can summarily deny that petition. And if that's the case, the offender can petition at any time, repetition rather, at any time, including the very next day. But then after the 60 days is over, the case comes over to the DA's office. We have an additional 60 days to do our own investigation. And again, this is just another level of scrutiny. And two things can happen. We can either concede the petition because the offender is eligible and we have no public safety concerns, or we can object and request a hearing. There is no set timeline for that hearing, but once that hearing is set, what the DA's office will do is we will present documentary evidence, because that's what the statute currently allows for, and submit our reasons why the court should deny the petition. And the court looks at various things, obviously the nature and the facts of the case. They'll look at the age and number of the victims, the relationship between the victims and the offender, the time period during which the offender was offense-free in the community, and whether or not the offender has successfully completed any sex offender treatment programs, among other things. And so the court can either then overrule our objection and still grant the petition, or it can deny the petition at that point. And if that's the case, the court then also has the option of setting a minimum wait period for the offender. It will be anywhere between 1 to 5 years. So for those offenders, you cannot repetition the very next day. You'll have to wait until the court tells you you can repetition. And to our victims out there, I want to assure you that our victim services division is tasked with contacting all of the victims for all of the petitions that are coming in. And if we do, whether or not we object, we will let you know, and you will have a chance to voice your opinions to our office and possibly to the court if we take a case to a contested hearing.
Let me turn it to Danielle from San Mateo. Danielle, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you so much. I had a question. This is going back to previous topic, but I understand that the purpose of the 290 registration list was previously for law enforcement investigative purposes, but I'm wondering about something I think Ms. McGuire said about punishing people who are on the 290 registration list, but I'm wondering if she would agree that there is a purpose beyond law enforcement uses for 290 registrants, and by I mean that is victims of the community, that we should in fact know if someone has been convicted of something that puts them on that list, or if she would disagree with that.
As I understood your question, you're really asking my guest if she agrees with the premise that there's really a purpose for this list other than to punish the people.
Well, not only other than to punish, more to be informative, not only to law enforcement engaged in investigations, but also to the general public. Like, should we know if someone has in fact been convicted of a 290 offense?
I think we have to stick to what's relevant. So I think, and believe me, I would fall victim to this myself personally. I think that there is a real danger in making assumptions about people because they're on that list, right? So you see that there is a name and a face of someone that lives in your neighborhood, and all of a sudden you want to move, or you tell your kids, don't go by that house, or You know, in some cases, you start taunting the individual, not you, but, you know, those people can become subjected to abuses by others in the neighborhood. And the question is, I mean, is their place on the registry connected in some way to that fear? I mean, is your fear justified? And if the science or the studies would show that that particular person, for the offense that they were convicted of during that point in time in their life and where they are now and what's happened in the meantime, there's no suggestion that they pose a threat to you or any of your other neighbors, then I do think it's inappropriate. Then I do think they're being subjected to being ostracized and being singled out unfairly. So that would be my position, yes. I think that if the registry was created as this investigative tool, then there should be something to back that up. There should be some reason to think that it serves as an appropriate investigative tool.
Okay.
And Danielle, if I could jump in and add to the answer that Lisa just gave. If the registry is so diluted to where the 50-something neighbor down the street is on the list because in his teens, at 18 years old, he swatted somebody on the behind with a towel in the locker room at 18, and now he's in his 50s and he's on the list. Mm-hmm. That doesn't do you a whole lot of good as a neighbor as far as assessing, does he still pose a threat? How safe am I with this guy down the street?
Right.
If we start realistically using the list as a tool to alert not only law enforcement but also the public as to only the dangerous folks and call a lot of these other folks out of it because they've been put there for life unnecessarily, you're better served as well.
And I will say that even with this change in the law, as Shin Mi has pointed out a couple of times, there are still a lot of levels to this. And I would say that everything about this law errs on the side of keeping more people on the registration list than removing people. It's not easy to get off. I mean, we're talking about a minimum period of time of 10 years. So we're not talking about relieving people of this registration requirement altogether. We're talking about trying to make it more relevant to the actual offense. And the lowest period of time is going to be 10 years minimum. So I think that there is still a significant level of, protection, if that's what you want to call it. But I still stand by my position that to keep someone on there to make people feel better or to make people feel safer, if that's not what the studies show is happening, if that's not the result of keeping someone on this list, then it's an inappropriate burden.
I also want to just for the record clarify that not all misdemeanor registrants are victimizing adults. We do have misdemeanor sex offenders who have victimized children. But for whatever reason that we could only charge or convict them of a misdemeanor.
But I would imagine that when the court and or law enforcement review, that will be a factor they take into account in looking not at the eligibility, but the suitability. Shinny,
yes.
You're nodding your head, but our radio listeners can't hear you nod your head.
No, I agree with that statement, Jeff.
Okay. Danielle, thanks for joining us. I hope that was a good answer for your question.
Thank you.
As we're getting close to the end of the hour, I wanted to give each of you 1 or 2 minutes to really sum up any closing thoughts, anything you want to express. Shin Mi, do you want to go first?
Sure. So this law balances the needs of law enforcement with those of the offenders who pose little to no risk to public safety. I want to reassure our victims that there are multiple levels of scrutiny that are built into this law, and that you will have a chance to be heard by our office on all of these petitions. And if you have any questions, please feel free to call our office.
Well, again, if you're somebody who is registering yourself and looking for that relief, that probably is not the office you want to call. But Lisa, would you like any last words?
I just want to reiterate that we're here to assist if people are seeking assistance in this regard.
And broadly, you mean if you're in San Mateo, call the Private Defender Program. If you're outside of San Mateo, where might people call?
Yes. And the phone number here at the office I'll give is 650-298-4000.
And Lana Creedy, would you like, or I'm sorry, Lana Creedy, I'm looking at your name spelled differently on the screen than it is elsewhere. Lana, would you like any last words?
I'll just say that this law represents the best of us as a criminal justice community. It brought together civil rights activists, district attorneys, law enforcement, defense organizations. It brought together a very wide coalition of people with a lot of experience with sex offenders and the criminal justice system. And it's just the result of data and research and science. And I think as a society, this is a representation of us progressing and making better decisions about how to keep our communities safe and how to treat the registrants fairly and how to treat the people that are the convicts fairly and ensure that they have equity and ensure that they're employable where it's safe and that they're able to live where they need to, where it's safe. And that's really a good thing. And I hope people can feel good about it. And yes, please call us if you need legal help.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight, we took a look at the changes affecting the regimen of registrations following a criminal conviction. This show has been produced by yours truly. Our guests tonight have been Assistant San Mateo County District Attorney Shinmi Chang, and from the Private Defender Program of the San Mateo County Bar, Chief Defender Lisa McGuire and Assistant Managing Attorney Lana Cradier. To each of our guests, thank you for joining us. And I really mean that. Thank you for joining us tonight in Your Legal Rights. We ask that you please join us again next week on Your Legal Rights, where we will discuss probate in the small estate. For all of our distinguished guests, and at the controls, Damian D. Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.